one that I really understand change is hard, it's complex, but please keep working with us. I really think that together we can make the scheme everything that we always envisaged it would be, and we can continue to deliver the life-changing supports that people with disability absolutely, I know, want.
Hi, I'm Dr. George Holland-Morris, and welcome to Reasonable and Necessary, Australia's premier podcast series for the National Disability Insurance Scheme, brought to you by the Summer Foundation. I'm coming to you from Wurundjeri land, and pay my respects to elders, past, present, and emerging. But before we go any further, please do me a favour and hit the like button, subscribe to the channel, and select the notification bell, so you can be notified of future episodes. In this episode, I'm joined by Rebecca Porkingham, the CEO of the NDIA. We will take you through the changes to the NDIS that have now been implemented, and we will find out how those changes will impact on participants. Check it out. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome to the show.
Hi, George. Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me.
Oh, so good to have you on. I have been really looking forward to this conversation. I mean, there are so many big changes to the NDIS right now, and I know that you've been very busy, so I really, really appreciate your time to take us through those changes. But firstly, I just want to acknowledge that there's a lot of stress and concern in the community. Do you understand why the community is feeling this way?
Thanks, George. It's an excellent question, and I just want to take the time to acknowledge that I understand that there is a lot of anxiety and there's a lot of concern in community. Change is always really, really hard. One of the things I always remind myself through the reform process at the moment is we are returning the NDIS back to its original intent. And that is what we all signed up to back in the very, very beginning. But I understand that we've had a scheme that has run for 11 years. Some things have worked enormously well, and some things, as we all know, have not worked very well. But I really want people to know that I listen to every piece of feedback that we get. I listen to every kind of conversation we have, whether it's with the community, whether it's with our wonderful IAC. We talk a lot right across the agency about what more we can do to reassure people about what the changes are. The best way I know to do that is to get people with disability into every single conversation that we're having about change. I know it might feel like the legislation is a lot of big change, but as we've discussed before, the big design features are not designed yet. We have to work deeply with proper co-design to design the new support needs assessment, to design the new budget model, how navigation will work. So I really encourage everyone, as I always do, now that the legislation is out of the parliament and it's at an implementation stage, to get involved with the agency in how we design the new system, because the strength of the NDIS will always be about having people with disability at the centre.
Indeed. I have been very impressed by how willing and open you've been to talk about things and to have those tough conversations. Mm-hmm. It's been really appreciated. What I'm hoping we can do today is just a bit of a quick summary of the things that are changing to start with, and then we'll go into a little bit dive into the detail.
Yeah.
So what changes are coming in immediately? Today, October 3rd.
October 3rd. Well, first of all, I just want to reassure most NDIS participants that you won't see any fundamental changes to the way you experience the NDIS right now. I think that's really important, that people aren't expecting that suddenly there's going to be a light that's going to go on and everything's going to change, because it just won't. What is not changing is the purpose, as I described before, of the NDIS. The NDIS will continue to give participants with disability-related supports when and how they need them. In terms, though, of starting today, if you are an existing participant, the changes are, there's just a handful of them. The first is the introduction of the definition of NDIS supports, and that's probably the change we've heard the most about. And that is being really clear about what your NDIS funding can and cannot be used for. And I know I'm sure we'll talk about that more, George. The next is what we have called, I think there's been a number of ways it's been described. It's been described as carve-outs. It's been described as substitution. The way we're referring to it now as we commence is to a replacement rule. So that allows a participant to request a different type of support that is not an NDIS support. That is only in individual circumstances. And that's because we listen to community really loudly around that there are some things on these lists that don't cater for the really unique circumstances that some participants have. So that's the other change. Also, plans that come into effect from today will now have a total funding amount and funding component amounts and funding periods. So that gives you a lot more clarity, a lot more control as a participant over what amount of money is in your plan, how long the plan is going to last. And as you know, as we move towards the bigger reforms, our hope is in the future that people will be able to have plans that go for 3, 4, or 5 years. We want to give people the choice and control over how long their plan is for. The other real change is how we consider your plan management type. As you've heard us talk about before, there are going to be some circumstances when we have to look at what is the best plan management type for a particular participant. And that is obviously trying to keep at the centre genuine choice and control and agency over a participant's plan. But obviously that there's obviously the choice of self-management, there's a choice of agency management, and there's a choice of plan management. In some cases, because of what we are seeing play out with fraud and often neglect and abuse, it's going to be really important that we as an agency can quickly respond to what is the best plan management type in absolute consultation and conversation with a participant. As you've heard me say this a lot, George, that this is kind of a last resort change. It's kind of when we want to make sure that safety is absolutely paramount in our consideration of the type of plan management you have. But we will talk to a participant about what their ultimate goal is in terms of what plan management type, and we will work as quickly as we possibly can to get people onto the type of plan management they would like for themselves. So they're the big changes that are coming into effect from today.
And there are things that are going to come into effect as a result of the new law down the track, aren't they? Can we have a bit of a quick overview of some of those that we can see in the future?
So the big changes into the future, and we're talking about probably in about a year's time, will be the new support needs assessments, the new budget tool that will give participants much more flexibility as to how they use their funding. And obviously, they're key critical things. They are absolutely going to be the core of the new planning framework into the future. But right now, all the legislation does is it gives us the scaffolding to allow us to do those things. So that will be done through co-design, and I think a lot of that work is actually already underway. And so, again, I really encourage people to get involved in those changes.
And I'm sure we'll do another podcast, won't we, Rebecca?
We will.
That all happens. All right, let's kind of deep now into the big change to start with, and that's the change to the definition of an NDIS support. Can you tell me through this definition? And I'm really interested in this conversation because there has been so much concern and angst around the definition. And I also think that there's an overwhelming response to the consultation that went on. And it wasn't an ideal process, was it? It was very rushed. Let's talk about that.
Thanks, George. No, it wasn't an ideal process at all. But one of the things that happens once the Parliament passes laws, as we all know, is there are a range of things that need to be put in place really quickly. And I know our colleagues at DSS have tried to make sure that they've been able to capture all the concerns, all the responses to the new, what we call Section 10, which is about the NDIS supports process. So let's just talk about that for a minute, because some people might not be familiar with it. So the government released definitions of NDIS supports just to make sure everyone is really, really clear what NDIS funds can and cannot be used for. They released a list of specific items that you are allowed to use and ones that you are not allowed to use. If it helps everyone, the way I try and think about it is those lists are based on existing guidance that have always been in place for the duration of the scheme. So for most people, they're unlikely to see any change to the supports that they are currently using. Because of the fact that these are Category A rules, and one of the changes that has come about through all of our discussions with the states and territories, is there are new processes around how rules are made, but longer term, Section 10 rule will be a Category A rule. So what that means is it has to be co-designed and consulted on with community and with the states and territories. So if you can think about Section 10, it's just in place because as soon as the bill gets passed, we have to have transitional arrangements in place so that the bill can operate. But there will be a lot more opportunities over the next 12 months to make sure that we get this rule right in relation to Section 10. So if people are concerned, if they're worried, please reach out to our team and we'll have a chat about what processes there are into the future for how things come in and out of the Section 10 lists. We do hope that those lists, from an agency perspective though, will help people to understand the new rules and find and use the right supports for them. As you say, I think that everyone would have appreciated a lot more time. I think there was about 7,300 submissions that came through the DSS portal. I tried to get through as many as I possibly could. I didn't get through all 7,300, but I absolutely spoke to so many different organisations and different people about how they were feeling about the rules. And I hope we've been able to bring about some changes to the rules that will help hopefully show A, people that we are listening right across government, but B, that there are some practical improvements to those lists as well. But I do want to also just keep reminding people that this is a transitional rule and that there will be a longer term Category A rule. So there will be more opportunities for, as you say, to run a really good process around consultation and ultimately really good co-design. And what we all agree is good co-design to make sure the Section 10 rule is everything we want it to be for the future.
I want to touch on some of the things that have been of real interest to the community. The menstrual products, so period pads and things that help people to manage that. I think they're now allowed, is that right?
Yeah, George. And again, it goes to the, it was not ideal. I think that that particular item was put under the wrong category. So as always, we apologise for any kind of anxiety that created, but menstrual products required specifically due to a participant support needs have been included in assistive products for personal care and safety, which is where I think they belong. But that absolutely, and we thank everyone who wrote to us about that, wrote to the minister and wrote to government about it. And hopefully that is a sign that we absolutely are listening and responding, and that is now included on the in list.
And hair washing and
Again, it was a really, really important item to discuss in a lot more detail. I think that historically, some of those items might have been incorrectly claimed for, or people might have been taking them just a few steps too far in relation to some of those claims. But
can we talk about that when the hair loss becomes a term, or?
It's a good question, and I'm probably not the right person to ask sometimes about some of these questions, but given my very limited knowledge about hair and nail care,
I have no hair, so
we'll both do our best at trying to explain this. But I think that, again, to go to kind of the social license of the scheme and kind of what people would expect for the scheme, there's no doubt for me that all Australians absolutely believe deeply in our scheme and that they would expect that care and nail care, where there was a specific function or a personal hygiene related to somebody's disability, would absolutely be on the in list. I think that people would not expect, though, that, you know, hairdressing appointments of, you know, $1,500 or more would not be on the list. So I think that we've spoken to a lot of people, and a lot of people have made some excellent suggestions. And I think we've hit the right balance now, that absolutely that hair and nail care is available where a participant does have, as I said, that specific function and or personal hygiene related need, you absolutely can claim for it. And I want to thank in particular, there have been a number of really vocal advocates on this issue, and I really appreciate their candor and how frank they've been, but also a number of the state and territory ministers have been very strong on this as well, and also for the need for us to think about that really important community connection piece that comes from being able to go to a nail salon or a hair salon. So I'm hoping that people see that as a step in the right direction.
I'd like to talk about that community connection element, because it's so important, and I know that in the original list there's a real criticism that it was going to force people into segregated services or prevent them from being part of community.
Yeah.
Has that been addressed in the changes?
Thanks, George. Again, it's a really good question. And again, one that I think it was actually one of the first pieces of feedback that I got on the list was in relation to that real focus on what was described as more specialist products, and how people felt about that, and how people felt about that they want to use absolutely maximise the value in their plan. And a number of participants that I spoke to spoke about how disempowering it was when you're required to buy a specialist product when you could walk into a Kmart and get a better value for money product that was equally of the same quality, potentially in some cases, not all, but in some. And so that real focus on specialist products has been replaced in certain places in the list with assistive products to support access to the most cost-effective solution. And I really thank everyone for all their feedback on that. It was really heartening to me as trying to get that right balance between scheme sustainability, but also absolutely choice and control for participants about where they would like to buy their supports from. And so again, I hope we've really hit the right balance on that item. And again, I'm sure we'll get other feedback as we work towards that longer term category A rule, but I'm hoping that people now feel much more empowered to buy those products at the place that they think best suits their needs and allows them to get best, the term, but best bang for their buck in their plan.
And the last one, the one that probably got the most media attention, is around sexual services and sex toys. The media just seemed obsessed by that topic, and we know that there were some concerns, particularly among women with disabilities, around the need for sexual support. How's the NDIA going to ensure that people's sexual needs and sexuality will be understood and supported?
Thanks, George. And as you would be aware, when the legislation was before the Parliament, there were some changes in the legislation. So there's no reference to sex toys in the list, with the intention that adaptive equipment can be funded. Sexual services is not defined in the legislation and therefore should be interpreted in its ordinary meaning. So that's physical and sexual activity between a participant and a sex worker. The NDIS will continue to provide reasonable and necessary funding to access disability-related support, such as adaptive equipment or sexual counselling. So I hope that helps. We will have more information available on the website that makes it clear to people about which of those services that we will provide under reasonable and necessary funding.
Thank you. I'm just looking at an example of a couple that I know, and both have disabilities, and the only way for them to be intimate is by having someone assistant with positioning, and that's something that I think is really important. How will the NDIS address these particular situations? Will there be a specific sexuality policy or a way of ensuring that those needs are supported?
I think, George, it's an excellent question, and no doubt that over the coming months, once we move towards those longer term Category A rules, we will have better operational guidance, but also, as you know, we often release would we fund it guidelines, and this is an area that we're very, very happy to have a look at. I always feel as though, to go to your point about it's the only issue the media is focused on, I always remind people of that, you know, it is such a small part of our scheme. I don't like people walking away thinking that kind of this is kind of, you know, an area that we fund, we provide a lot of funding. We don't. But absolutely, as I said, if it is reasonable and necessary supports, we will fund it. I think we do have some information already available on our website, but obviously with these changes under the legislation, we'll have a look at whether we need a bit more operational guidance and would we fund it as well. So thank you for that question.
I'm a little interested now to talk about the transition that we're going to undergo around getting our heads around this new definition. There's going to be people who will still buy things or that they didn't realise isn't a support. People are worried that they're going to be subjected to debts that they're not going to be able to repay. What will happen to support people through the transition?
Yeah, George, this has been really important for me, and particularly working with our Chair, Kurt Fernley, and Minister Shorten. We've had some really excellent conversations about what does it mean to be education first, particularly when a lot of these changes aren't new and will take people a little while to adjust and adapt to. We know that participants want to do the right thing, but we've also heard a lot of concerns about what if I accidentally buy something which is not an NDIS support. So, as I said, our focus will be on supporting people and educating people. We've provided a lot of training and support to our staff to really help them kind of be really education first in our focus. But there will be, we're really pleased to be able to say that there will be a transition period for the first year of the new NDIS supports list. We want to make sure people can take the time to learn and understand those new lists. And so during the transition period, and as I said, most of the lists are based on existing guidance, so we hope they're not too much of a change for everyone. And there's information also on our website if you're unsure about what you can fund on. But if you make a mistake and you accidentally claim an NDIS support which is not funded, we'll be in touch with you to let you know what's happened and help you understand what to do. There won't be a debt raised in the first 12 months if you have made a mistake or inadvertently claimed an NDIS support which is not on the list. But there is a point of clarification, though. If the agency believes that it's not a mistake, it's been a willful deliberate kind of breach of the rules, then we will look at further action that needs to be taken. But for the first 12 months, if you make a mistake and you have inadvertently made a claim for something that is not on the NDIS support list, we will work with you. I just want to reassure people a debt won't be raised against you. One of the changes, having listened to the parliamentary debate as I did, obviously there was a lot of concern around debt, and that concerned me greatly. And so we've made a bit of a tweak in the agency that if the agency was ever to pursue a debt against a participant, it would need to be signed off by me first. And so that puts a whole lot of safety nets through the process to kind of make it be really clear that raising any debt against a participant would be an absolute last resort. I'm making separation between providers and plan managers and participants deliberately, because this transitional rule applies for participants. So as I said, for the first 12 months, everyone will be getting to know the lists and making sure they're compliant with the lists. We will work, we will educate people, but there won't be a debt raised unless, as I said, it's willful and deliberate kind of breaching of the rules. So I hope that gives people some reassurance about how we're going to approach the next 12 months.
I think that's really welcome. Thank you for your leadership on that. And I understand that if they are using a plan manager, that allowance won't apply, is that right?
So as is the current case, that would not be a debt raised against a participant. That would be a debt raised against a plan manager. So there's a fair bit of nuance on that. So we'll have information on our website. But I want to assure people, because a lot of people use plan managers, we're really clear that plan managers know what their expectations are. They know what they've got to be absolutely assisting participants. They should be in a really good place to know what you can and can't claim for. It's one of the things they sign up for to be a plan manager, is being compliant with the NDIS legislation. But that is not a debt against a participant.
Okay. And they'll have 30 days, I believe.
So for any provider or plan manager, there's a 30-day grace period. And to give people just a little bit of time, if they're a provider or a plan manager, to get used to the NDIS supports list. So for the first 30 days, no debt will be raised against a plan manager or a provider.
Excellent. I'm interested in how the community is going to be supported to get our heads around all this.
Yeah.
Are there particular initiatives that will be happening?
There will be a lot of communication and a lot of education during this period. We are trying to make everything available. I think everything's going to be available in 17 different languages, including Auslan, and that we're trying to make everything as easy read as possible. I know that people will be patient as we get that right, because it's a lot of materials that we need to make sure we get out into community as quickly as possible. If you call our national contact centre at the moment, I think that the first number that you're directed to is if you have any requests for questions or information about the new legislation, they can help you answer it. I should say they don't know absolutely everything, so in some instances they might direct you to someone else in the agency if they don't know the answer.
I also understand that participants will be able to use something that is on the cart buy list by getting that approved as a replacement support, is that right?
That's right, George. So that was one of the things we heard really loudly and clearly from the community, is that we know that all participants have their own really unique support needs, and in specific circumstances, participants might need to use their funding for a support that is not an NDIS support. So we wanted a bit of flexibility, and during the consultation process, we heard that there were a lot of concerns that defining NDIS supports would mean participants might need to access really specialist kind of services. And so we started to look at kind of what is now known as the replacement rule. So those the replacements will enable participants to request a substitute to one of the supports that's in their plan that is not an NDIS support, such as a standard household item. It's really important to know, though, that like some of the examples people use and is on the replacement list is an Apple or any kind of smartwatch. What needed to be made clear that it wouldn't be appropriate for all 650,000 plus participants to have access to an Apple smartwatch, and wouldn't meet the expectations, I think, around financial sustainability. But there's some amazing technologies that absolutely should be used to substitute supports that help with better access to community, better value for money. And so that will be a key part of the new Section 10, is that we're sharing information about how this new process will work, and we'll work with people to help them understand what the information they need to provide to us to confirm a replacement support. We are trying to make that process as seamless as possible. The last thing we want is another clunky bureaucratic process that takes, you know, months and months and months and lots of reports. We don't want that. We want to make it as simple as possible who need a replacement item. We've already been working through with consultation what that process might look like. And now that we've got a little bit more time, we will now move that into more of a co-design process in relation to how replacement processes work. And as I said earlier, that is also something that will be negotiated as part of the final Category A rule into the future. But for right now, there are absolutely replacement items that are absolutely available to participants.
And I understand that there'll be like an easy to complete application form, and that will get approved very quickly, and then you can just get on with it, right?
Exactly. And we'll have a dedicated team in the agency who get more familiar with making quick decisions about replacement items. So you're not going to be put to a planner who doesn't understand kind of how the replacement process works. It will be a dedicated replacement team that can work really quickly on your proposed replacement.
Help us understand that if something is already in your plan and that you can still use that support for the duration of the plan, is that right?
That's right, George, that you can, we will honour if something is stated in your plan. There's not a lot of things, though. We've done a bit of an audit of things that are currently stated in plans that would be on the NDIS outlist. There's not many of those, but if that is in your plan, we will absolutely honour it for the duration of your plan.
All right, let's get on to the separate pathway to access. Section 21 talks about an early intervention pathway. Who would that apply for, and how would the experience be different?
Yes. So from October 3, which I think is a great initiative, is that we will have to, as an agency, be clearer with everyone about why you've met access to the NDIS. So just to go through them briefly, there are three different ways that you can have met access. The first is under Section 24, and that is disability requirements. Section 25 is the early intervention requirements. Or the third pathway is that you could be on both and you might have been accepted onto the scheme for both disability and early intervention requirements. But that's not going to change anything for you right now, other than you'll be told kind of why you've been given access to the scheme. And I think that one of the things that I think we've talked about since I kind of joined the agency is the need for the agency to be much more transparent. The number of people that I know that don't actually know the reasons that they were given access to the scheme is quite mind-boggling. So that's a great step forward, that you will be told why you what pathway you've been put on within the scheme. Nothing will change for you right now, though, and the reason for that is that in the future, and this is why this has to be deeply co-designed, and it would not be appropriate to turn any of these things on until everyone is really comfortable, is a participant will be supported to have a much more tailored planning experience depending on how you've been given access to the scheme. Those changes, once those pathways are created, and we've already got some co-design groups working on this, but it will take time to create those new pathways. We think it will probably take 10 to 12 months to work with our community, work with participants, be that on our participant reference group or just generally kind of, we've had a lot of interest in people wanting to be involved in the co-design, and we really encourage that, but people will be involved in how best to implement those new pathways so that people who need access, for example, to the early intervention requirement will be supported by the new early intervention pathway. And there'll be much more clarity about what are the types of supports that you get on the early intervention pathway. And that's important, particularly for children. And we know there's been a lot of anxiety in relation to what some of these changes mean for kids. But I can just assure everyone that there is no change access as a result of the decision to make sure that we're telling people why they've been given access. But we will be, over the next 12 months, designing a much, much better early intervention pathway.
Okay, that's a watch this space one.
Yes.
Clearly. Supports will need to be linked to a person's impairment. Mm-hmm. And in January, there'll be some impairment notices that we're going to receive. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to make sure people are not getting anxious about these notices. But from the 1st of January next year, which seems like a long way away, but it's only a couple of months, when you meet access to the NDIS, we will send you what's been referred to and will be known as an impairment notice. This change recognises that people with disability who have the same diagnoses may have different impairments and support needs. So an impairment notice will be a document that says you have a permanent disability or significant impairment there were six categories that were introduced in the new laws, which are intellectual, cognitive, sensory, neurological, physical, and psychosocial. We will tell you which impairment category or categories you meant access for in your impairment notice, and that means you'll have a much clearer understanding of the impairments you meant access for. Obviously, there are absolutely tests that we need to meet in relation to the access to the scheme, and they're already processes everyone's quite familiar with. Over time, we will work with all participants to make sure that they do have that impairment notice, and that approach does align with the disability and early intervention requirements for access. I should say, though, because I know this has been a concern to people, that participants may have multiple impairments that meet disability requirements or early intervention requirements, and they will all be on your impairment notice. And I should say as well that you can absolutely challenge that notice in terms of if you believe that you have other impairments that should be on your notice. There will be a really clear process for you to be able to, again, test access for that impairment. We're trying to make, again, once you've met access, obviously we want to make it as seamless as possible, that if you do have additional impairments, you're not going to go way back to the start again and start your access process again. We're really working through with co-design how to make that a really, really simple process for people to be able to change their impairment notices when appropriate.
So this is like one word, but that's like physical or intellectual. Is that as detailed as the impairment notice will be?
That's what we're working through at the moment, George. Okay. They're the categories that are in the laws. But what we want to work through with participants is, for example, as you know, we're getting much, much better in the agency at co-designing forms and processes in a really, really clear way. So we'll be working through co-design what those impairment notices look like, so that they're helpful, that they're not anxiety inducing, that people really understand the purpose of them. And they're as clear as we could possibly make them. But as I said, there will be processes that also make it simple for people to also ask questions or to challenge that impairment notice.
What if you have a physical disability and as a result of that physical disability you have psychosocial needs, how will that be dealt with?
So if you've met access for that psychosocial impairment, that will be on your notice as well.
The reason I raise this is because some people have multiple impairments that stem from their primary impairment or their main impairment. Is that kind of the dot with in the kind of design work?
Well, as you know, one of the reasons we're making this change is that for a long time people have been confused and frustrated and quite annoyed with the process around primary and secondary disabilities. So what we want to make sure with these new categories is, as I said, that they are clear to people why they have been given access to the scheme. And it does recognise that people have different impairments and different support needs. It's very hard to respond to kind of hypothetical situations without knowing all the unique circumstances that sit behind an individual. But absolutely, if your psychosocial impairment relates to your physical impairment and both meet the threshold to access, they will both appear on your impairment notice.
Okay, what will people do if they think there's an error in the notice?
Yeah, it's a good question. So participants, as I said, once they've got the clear understanding of kind of why they've met access for the impairments that they've met access for, when an individual gets an impairment notice, we will ensure that the NDIA provides a planning experience and planned funding outcomes, which are tailored. Participants can seek a variation to add or remove impairments at any time after they've met access. So if a participant disagrees with a decision about their impairments, they can ask for a review, and absolutely that can go through all the normal processes that people are very familiar with now.
You mentioned that the NDIA will have the power to change a person's plan management type. Mm-hmm. In what circumstances might that occur?
Thanks, George. I always kind of want to sometimes language that appears in legislation is not how we will approach things. So I hate kind of thinking that the NDIA will decide anything absent kind of talking to a participant about what they want and their circumstances. So that will always be our starting point. And it's always the message I give to all of our people that absolutely though, that if there are concerns, if there are risks identified and the NDIA is not allowed to support a participant's request to self-manage if we are concerned about those risks. So that's really putting the onus on the NDIA as well to make sure we are keeping participants safe, consistent with some of the discussion in the Royal Commission. The NDIA will have to consider if a participant or their plan nominee has any major criminal convictions. That was one of the changes that the Parliament made. A participant's funding will absolutely... as I said at the start, we will make sure we do everything to get a participant back to the type of plan management that they would like for themselves. But if we are concerned about any red flags, and as I said, that might be around risk or mismanagement of a plan, we can take steps to try and make sure that, after a conversation with the participant, that we're making the right decision about what the right plan management type is.
Funding periods, they're going to change. I understand that plans in the dead of October will be a maximum 12 months. But that interests me because I'm thinking to myself, you're creating a lot of work for the agent.
It is a lot of work for us. And one of the things, obviously, is that the NDIS review made some recommendations around the timing in which to transition participants to the new planning scheme. So once we've got through the next 12 months and once we've co-designed the new support needs assessment, once we've co-designed the new budget model and how the navigation system will work, we will start to transition participants to that new planning framework. And I should say that obviously a key component of that will be looking at longer, more flexible plans. As I said, ideally, having spoken to a lot of people, they'd like a five-year plan. They'd like us to absolutely have no involvement in their life. And absolutely, if there are no risks or there's no concerns around that, then absolutely that is something that we will try and deliver for the participant. So plans will have, though, until we are on that new planning framework, because we don't want to put people through multiple processes if we can help it. And we want to make sure that participants can have access to their funding in their plan at any time. So that a lot of participants have also spoken to me about wanting to have their funding flow in different kind of increments. So we will have much more flexibility around how those plans are actually built into the future. And as I said, the desire to have much longer funding periods will be a key part of how we design the new planning framework. But for all new plans, as you say, from October 3, we'll have a funding period of 12 months until the new planning framework is in place, when we can have much longer, more tailored responses to A, how long the total plan is, but A, how the funding periods flow as well.
Yeah, on the issue of the funding period and the like an installment, won't there?
Not for everyone. Obviously, we will have a look at whether there's been plan overutilization. As you know, we've had issues, and I'm the first to understand that there are often really good reasons why someone has overspent their plan. But it's really important that we can help manage that risk. Underspent plans will roll over still between the planning periods. No one's losing funding if they kind of don't spend it in that period. But we wanted to have the flexibility to allow us to be able to look at issues like personal preference, the frequency and type of supports that people are receiving, also any potential risks around how funding is flowing. It's not normal that kind of, you know, money flows in the way that it often does. People are often quite used to getting instalment payments so that they can manage their funds over whatever plan period they've got. But we will obviously work closely with participants in considering what those funding periods best suit that person's life and how they want to manage their plan. But as I said, there will be now the mechanism, though, that if there is concerns around fraud and overutilization, and as you know, often that's not a participant's fault. There might be other people that are bringing about that outcome, and we want to make sure participants are aware of that and have transparency over that, and we can talk about what the best arrangements are for the participant.
What if people want to appeal decisions? I think that appeals have been a real area of concern that they'll be hearing that people can send a directly out to appeal a debt, if a debt's being raised against them, and all of those things that, you know, where someone might make a mistake, or a person working for the agency might make a mistake, can those decisions be appealed?
So NDIS participants have and always will continue to have a right to review their NDIS package and their level of supports. The legislative changes to the Parliament do not change that right. I think that what everyone has become a little bit confused about is at what point can you bring about that review? And to go to the issue we've just discussed just now, a participant can appeal their plan management decision. That should follow an internal NDIA appeal process, which includes that we'd look at the, we'd have someone that hasn't been involved in that original decision on the plan management process, and we'd ask a participant whether they have any more supported, any information to support kind of why that decision was not right. Participants can seek a variation to add or remove impairments at any time after they meet access. And if a participant disagrees with a decision, they can ask for an independent review. So I know this has become very confusing. It's been very, very much a focus of mine to reassure people that they absolutely do retain their right of review. Our website will set out really, really clearly how people go about doing that. But I think that what confused everyone was at what point can you appeal your decision? And as I said, you can appeal your plan management type, you can appeal your funding periods, you can appeal your total budget. So that is absolutely still part of our process. And importantly, you can appeal your the impairments that are in your impairment notice. So I want to assure people that review rights will always remain a fundamental part of this scheme. And in fact, if anything, we want to make it easier. As you know, we've done a lot of work in the agency over the last 2 years to try and reduce the number of reviews. We've reduced our AAT numbers quite significantly. The last thing I would want is for people to feel that they don't have a voice, that they can't contest a decision made by the agency. I'm the first to say we make mistakes every single day, and people have every right to review and ask for changes when we get things wrong. So I'd really like people to be assured of that.
Well, Rick, I think we've covered all the main changes. Is there anything that we missed?
I don't think so. Do you think nothing else that comes to mind? As I said, like, I'm really keen that we keep talking, because I think that your podcast, which, as you know, I listen to all the time, is going to be a really important source of truth for people to hear about changes as they roll out and they progress. And if anyone has any questions or any concerns coming out of the discussion we've had today, I'd really encourage people to write to me, write to the agency, and we'll do everything we can to clarify. As you know, I hate people being anxious. I don't want people to be anxious. I want people to feel assured that we are getting the scheme back to where it should be.
Thank you, Rebecca. It's been a really helpful conversation. Thank you for your very clear and honest way of working with our community. There's a lot of work to come in co-designing, and I think that that's going to be really important that our community is heard in that time. And are there any last words that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think I would just like to say to everyone that I really understand change is hard, it's complex, but please keep working with us. I really think that together we can make the scheme everything that we always envisaged it would be, and we can continue to deliver the life-changing supports that people with disability absolutely I know want. So a huge thank you to everyone who's provided feedback so far. Keep providing it. We've got thick skins, so keep providing your very frank and fearless advice to us when we get things wrong. We don't mind if you want to tell us we've got something right occasionally as well, but I just want to thank everyone for the robust way that they've engaged in the reforms, and know that we always want to do better in the NDIA to deliver the best possible world-leading service.
And that's what we all want. Thank you for your time, Rebecca.
Thanks, George. Lovely to speak to you.
That's all we have time for on today's episode of Reasonable and Necessary. If anything that we've discussed today has raised issues for you, please seek out support, and if you need it, the number for Lifeline is 13 11 14. As you know, we love your feedback, so please share your thoughts in the comments section And thank you so much for listening. Until next time, stay well and reasonable.